I think Johannes has heard half of this talk and Vincent has heard the other half, but I don't think anyone else has heard any of it. So hopefully nobody will be bored. The part of what I'm going to talk about is joint work with Jason Lotte, and part is with Dominic Joyce, and part of it is another work of my own. I am a mathematician, I'm not a physicist, so there are going to be theorems, but there are not going to be any proofs. Ask questions whenever you want. I hope I can explain to you something about what G2 conifolds are and why they're useful. Jaume asked me to put in some physics, to put in especially some connections to mirror symmetry, and I obliged. I added three new slides to the beginning of the talk, but they're all going to have a question mark at the end, which means please don't ask me questions about that because I'm not an expert in the physics. I'll tell you a little bit of what I've heard. And if you know more and want to educate me, I would be happy to hear that after lunchtime. So again, you're learning about what M-theory is from someone who doesn't know what it is. It's an 11-dimensional theory that's compactified on a 7-manifold. And for supersymmetry reasons, apparently the 7-manifold needs to have a parallel spinner, which means, because we know which compact Riemannian manifolds can have parallel spinners, that it has to be what's called a G2 manifold. This means the holonomy of the Riemannian metric is contained in the exceptional Lie group G2. And there's a way you can view G2 as sitting inside SO7. So that's you expect that because there's a metric and an orientation there. And these are all preserved by the Levi-Civita connection. So some of this will be repetition because I inserted these three slides this week. They're always Ricci flat. So there are 7-dimensional analogs of Calabi-Yau threefolds. So those are the ones you use when you're on a 6-dimensional compactification space in string theory. And these are the sort of analogs in one dimension up. And they have a lot of properties in common with Calabi-Yau threefolds or Calabi-Yau manifolds in general. They have special classes, for example, of submanifolds. One class is called associative submanifolds. These are the analogs of the J-holomorphic curves. They're 3-dimensional. And another special class of submanifolds are the co-associative submanifolds, and these are the analogs of special Lagrangian submanifolds in a Calabi-Yau. Why the reason for the name associative and co-associative, you'll get a hint later on in a few slides, but it doesn't really matter for the purposes of this talk because I'm not going to be talking about these submanifolds. But there are special classes, and I want to say that to relate it to the mirror symmetry. So what's mirror symmetry? Well, in string theory, you can have two different Calabi-Yau threefolds that give you the same physics, and we call that mirror symmetry. What does it mean mathematically? Well, we still don't know the full answer, but we know much more than we used to. The aspect of mirror symmetry that is of interest to me is the differential geometric approach from Strominger-Yau-Zaslow. And that conjecture, it's not even really right to call it a conjecture because it's not precisely formulated mathematically still, but essentially it says, and this is predicted from the physical arguments, that if you have a Calabi-Yau threefold, there should be a fibration, should be a smooth surjective map onto a real 3-dimensional manifold where the generic fiber is a special Lagrangian torus. And what you do then is you take the dual torus of all the non-singular fibers, and then you have to do something which no one really quite understands completely yet to compactify and get the mirror manifold. Now, in some cases, a lot of progress has been made here in the topological or symplectic setting by various people, and more recently, some work of Denis Auroux and Marc Grosse and other people, separate work, has we've come a long way since the conjecture was made, but we still have an even longer way to go, I think. It's close to the large complex structure limit in the moduli space, yeah. Okay, and there should, again, question mark, be an analogous notion of mirror symmetry for G2 manifolds. Again, I don't really know the details, but some papers of Acharya and some other people suggest that there should be that if you have a G2 manifold, again, probably not all of them, but certain G2 manifolds should admit a fibration, again, over a 3-manifold. And this time the generic fibers are co-associative 4-manifolds, and they can be tori or they can be K3s. And the reason why you want a tori here or a torus or a K3 here is because of a theorem of MacLean that says that if you have these are called calibrated submanifolds, then they have a smooth deformation space, and the dimension of the deformation space can be calculated from the topology of the submanifold, the intrinsic topology of the submanifold. And these are exactly what you need so that varying these calibrated submanifolds foliates the whole manifold, gives you the right dimension. Anyway, That's all I'm going to say about mirror symmetry. Right? So the rest will have nothing to do with mirror symmetry. No one knows how to do this yet at all. Right? We know much less about this than we do about that. And one of the reasons, which I'll emphasize in a few slides, is that you can't really use algebraic geometry to study G2 manifolds.
Is there a relation between the
There is, and I'll point it out later. Okay, and the last slide about physics is that in contrast to the Calabi-Yau world, where you want smooth Calabi-Yaus, what the physicists tell me and other mathematicians is that they don't want smooth G2 manifolds. They want singular ones. So I just copied a cover page of a paper by Acharya and Gukov from 2004. It says M-theory compactifications on G2 manifolds, whilst supersymmetric, they require singularities in order to obtain non-abelian gauge groups, chiral fermions, and other properties necessary for a realistic model of particle physics. I don't know what most of these words mean, right? But I trust them that they want singular G2 manifolds. And in fact, the singularities that have been considered mostly so far in the physics literature are conical singularities. It's still not clear to me, because I don't have the qualifications to sort of digest most of these papers, if the physics wants the singularities to be conical, or if we're just starting with these because you can actually compute some things explicitly, and these are the simplest example. But mathematicians like to start from the beginning anyway. So we're looking at G2 manifolds with isolated conical singularities. And the rest of the talk, well, first I'm going to introduce you to G2 manifolds in general, the smooth setting, tell you a little bit about the history, the mathematical history, and then I'll focus on G2 conifolds and tell you what we know, what we don't know, what we want to find out. Okay. So the next few slides are just about the smooth setting of G2 manifolds, and I'll talk about the relation to Calabi-Yaus. So here's the definition for a mathematician. You take a smooth seven-dimensional manifold. A G2 structure is a reduction of the structure group of the frame bundle from GL7R to G2. And like I said, there's a way to look at G2 as sitting inside SO7. This is a sort of a topologist definition. That means you can cover it by charts where the overlap functions, it means exactly this, the reduction of the structure group. You either know what that means or you don't, so don't worry about it. You can classify when this exists. This is a purely topological question. It turns out for a seven manifold to have a G2 structure, I shouldn't touch the screen. For a seven manifold to have a G2 structure, it's equivalent to the manifold being orientable in spin. So the first two Stiefel-Whitney classes have to vanish. So not every seven manifold has these, but lots of seven manifolds have G2 structures. And the way a differential geometer prefers to think about these is that it's not at all obvious from the definition, but a G2 structure, the information is encoded by a non-degenerate 3-form. So you should think of this as being analogous to a non-degenerate 2-form, that's what's a presymplectic structure, except the notion of non-degeneracy is actually much more rigid here. It's much stronger. So I will explain a little bit about how to think about this 3-form. But you have a special kind of smooth 3-form, which has some kind of algebraic property at every point on the manifold. And in fact, this 3-form determines a Riemannian metric and an orientation in a nonlinear way. I'll give you a hint soon about how that happens. So you can't have a 3-form without also having a Riemannian metric coming along for the ride. And therefore, you have a Hodge star, and you can take the dual 4-form, and I'm calling that psi. Oops. But I haven't defined G2 manifold yet. This is manifold with G2 structure. The way to think about this, for example, a manifold with an almost complex structure is one which allows you to canonically identify every tangent space with a complex vector space. Right? A manifold with G2 structure is one whose tangent space everywhere can be canonically identified with the imaginary octonion. So that's the imaginary part of an eight-dimensional non-associative real division algebra. So the non-associativity makes things a little complicated. This, again, is not going to be relevant for the rest of the talk, so you can ignore it. Now I can tell you what a G2 manifold is. So take a manifold with G2 structure. It has a Riemannian metric coming along for the ride, naturally, so you have a Levi-Civita connection. And we say that it's a G2 manifold if this Levi-Civita connection is parallel, or constant, as the physicists would say. We also call this a torsion-free G2 structure, because nabla phi is a tensor called the torsion of the G2 structure. And you can relate this to the torsion of some other connection. It's not important here. So what are the properties of G2 manifolds? Like I already said, the holonomy of the Riemannian metric is contained in the Lie group G2. So these are, and if the holonomy is G2, we call it an irreducible G2 manifold. It turns out that if you know the holonomy is contained in G2, so if it's a G2 manifold, then exactly what the holonomy is depends on the topology. You have, if it's simply connected, you can have G2, SU3, SU2, or trivial. And to know exactly which category you're in, if it's simply, well, not even if it's simply connected, which category you're in is determined uniquely by the topology. So it turns out that if it's contained in G2, then it's equal to G2 if and only if pi 1 is finite. So this is one way to find examples of irreducible G2 manifolds, is you work very hard to get a G2 manifold, to get a torsion-free G2 structure, and then because you know the topology, you can argue that the holonomy is exactly G2. I'll say more about that soon. As I mentioned, the metric is Ricci flat, not at all obvious. They have a parallel spinner, and so they're important in physics. Turns out that that you can characterize the torsion-free condition in terms of the three form and the dual four form are both closed. So phi is a harmonic three form. Now, this is a bit non-trivial because any parallel form is always closed and co-closed, but the converse is not true. So the other direction, that these vanishing implies nabla phi is zero, is a slightly non-trivial theorem of Fernandez and Gray. It just uses representation theory. It's just linear algebra. And these forms are both what's called calibrations. So they determine these distinguished three- and four-dimensional submanifolds. Okay, I want to give a comparison of G2 geometry with Kähler and Calabi-Yau geometry, because, of course, this audience knows a lot about Calabi-Yau geometry. So they're very similar to Kähler manifolds, G2 manifolds, because they have this three form, which is analogous to the Kähler form. There's a metric as well. There's actually a structure analogous to the complex structure, which is called a cross product. So they have a lot of the same kind of objects on them. They both have special submanifolds. You can talk about special connections, just like Hermitian-Einstein or Hermitian-Yang-Mills connections on Calabi-Yaus or Kähler manifolds. You can talk about what's called Donaldson-Thomas connections. It's the same paper, but it's different from what you usually hear about Donaldson-Thomas invariants. They both have special decompositions of their cohomology, just like in Kähler geometry. And that gives you restrictions on the topology. So for example, you can show that if you have a compact G2 manifold, that B3 has to be at least 1, the third Betti number, and that if you want the holonomy to be G2, then B1 has to be 0. But unlike G2 manifolds, of course, not all Kähler manifolds are Ricci flat. Those are the Calabi-Yaus. And by Yau's theorem, we know exactly which compact Kähler manifolds can have a Ricci flat Kähler metric. But we're very, very far away from having a similar theorem in G2 geometry. So we don't even know what the right conjecture should be. And the way you should view this is consider the following question. Suppose you have a compact manifold that admits almost complex structures. We know that it'll always admit Riemannian metrics. So if it admits almost complex structures, it admits what's called an almost Hermitian structure. Now, what are necessary and sufficient conditions that it admits an honest Kähler structure? We certainly know some necessary conditions, but we have no idea what sufficient conditions are. So that's the kind of question it's like. Okay, do I have anything else here? No, I don't. I want to keep going about this comparison with Kähler G2 geometry and Kähler and Calabi-Yau. I want to argue that G2 geometry is more nonlinear than Calabi-Yau geometry, than Kähler geometry. So the nice thing about Kähler geometry, this is a really helpful result, is the Didi-Bar lemma. So the Didi-Bar lemma says that if you have essentially two closed 1-1 forms in the same cohomology class, then they differ by not just d of a one form, but by Didi-Bar of a function, of a real function. And you can use the Kähler geometry often to reduce a first-order system of PDEs on your manifold to a single scalar equation. So for example, the complex Monge-Ampère equation that Yau solved to prove the Calabi conjecture starts out as a more complicated equation, but using the Didi-Bar lemma several times, you reduce it to a single scalar equation. It's still a very hard equation to solve, but it's an equation for one function. But all the natural PDEs that come up in G2 geometry are first-order, fully nonlinear systems. So you can't, it's a system. It's usually an equation for a one form or a vector field or something. So you can't reduce it to just a scalar equation. The other thing is that in Kähler geometry, the Kähler form, the complex structure, And the Kähler geometry, the symplectic geometry, if you want, and the complex geometry are essentially independent, and together they combine to give you the metric, to give you the Riemannian geometry. There's some mild compatibility conditions, right? You want to consider, like for example, you want omega to be tamed by, or j to be tamed by omega or whatever it is. But these are mild, and they're essentially independent. And that's how you can talk about the complex geometry or the symplectic geometry of a Kähler manifold independently. But this doesn't happen in G2 geometry. So I hinted before that the three form determines the metric. And this is how it does it. This is if you look at this equation here, take two vector fields on your manifold. Take a 7 manifold with a 3 form. Put one vector field into the 3 form. That's the interior product. And put the other one here and wedge them together. And then wedge with the 3 form again. And the left-hand side is symmetric in U and V because two forms commute. And it's a top form. It's a 7 form. So this is some function of U and V, which is symmetric, times a top form. Now, this is one way you can understand what does it mean for a non-degenerate 3 form. If it turns out that this right-hand side is a symmetric, is a positive definite bilinear form times a nowhere vanishing n form, then from there you can extract the metric. And so that's what that's a way of thinking about non-degeneracy. The left-hand side is only dependent on the 3 form. So if this is actually something positive definite times something nowhere vanishing, then you can pull out the metric and the orientation separately. And you can write down, might as well write this formula down. You can write down the metric in terms of the 3 form in a nonlinear way. So if you haven't seen this before, let me just do it in local coordinates. Take d by dx I, interior product with phi, and then d by dx j, interior product with phi, and then phi again. And whatever this is, it's some function which is symmetric in I and j times dx1 up to dx7. And to get something that transforms in the right way to be a metric, the right thing you have to do, there's some universal constant here which is not relevant. You have to take b and divide by the determinant of b to the 1/9. Okay, so when you do this formula, first of all, whatever you get here has to have non-zero determinant. And second, when you take b and you divide by determinant b to the 1/9, whatever you get here has to be definite. If it's negative definite, you can change by sign, but it has to be definite. So these are open conditions, but then you see that the metric is this horrible nonlinear function of phi, because b is essentially cubic in phi, and then you're taking b divided by a determinant b to the 1/9. That's the volume form of the Riemannian metric. So at the end of the day, when you do this, you get gij times square root of determinant of g is equal to b. So phi determines the combination g phi times volume phi. Yeah, but now because you know it's 7 dimensional, from here just linear algebra extracts them both separately. Okay, so phi determines the metric, determines the volume form, and then this other object which plays the role of the complex structure, which is a cross product, comes from phi and g. So you don't have sort of independent geometries that decouple. Everything comes always at the same time. Okay, examples. The first complete and non-compact examples of G2 manifolds were 1989 by Robert Bryan and Simon Salomon. And the manifolds, the underlying manifolds, are total spaces of vector bundles. So you have these bundles of anti-self dual 2 forms on S4 or CP2, or the spinner bundle on S3. So they're either rank 3 bundles over a 4 manifold or rank 4 bundles over a 3 manifold. All these examples are what's called asymptotically conical. I will give you the proper definition of asymptotically conical in a few more slides, but they're going to be important because we'll see that these are the only known examples of asymptotically conical G2 manifolds. So I'm saying that they look like cones far away from the base. I'll make that precise soon. And there's lots of other complete examples with nice behavior and infinity, most of them found by physicists. And all of these things are Comagen 81. I think they're all Comagen 81. Most of them are. And that means that they assume that there's enough symmetry in the problem to reduce the nonlinear PDE that you want to solve. What do you want to solve? You want to solve nabla phi is 0. Right? It looks linear, but remember, nabla depends on the metric, which depends on phi in a nonlinear way. So this is a fully nonlinear PDE for the 3 form. But if you assume there's enough symmetry, you can reduce it to a still fully nonlinear, but a system of ODEs, so functions of one variable. And often some kind of magic happens and you can solve these exactly. And but you can show very simply using the Bochner-Weizenbach formula that a compact G2 manifold, irreducible, because we want to construct irreducible examples. A compact one can't have any symmetry at all. So you won't be able to construct compact irreducible G2 manifolds by some kind of nice ansatz, which makes it simpler. Okay. Yeah, in the compact case? Or? Yeah, it is, and it's coming up in 2 slides. Yeah. Okay, so compact examples. So far, there are many known compact examples, not as many as Calabi-Yau's, because again, there's nothing like the Yau theorem. All of these are found so far by gluing techniques. So you construct a compact smooth manifold by patching together pieces of other things, usually non-compact things.
You have a parenthesis.
Yes. Yes. But that's not irreducible. So I thought that was on my slides, but if it's not, let me say it here. No, so if you have a Calabi-Yau threefold times a circle, that's a compact 7 manifold, and then you can take the 3 form to be the real part of the holomorphic volume form minus d theta wedge the Kähler form. And this is, if this is Calabi-Yau, this is a torsion-free G2 structure, but it has holonomy SU3. Yeah, and you get something smooth? Yeah, no, I want smooth. Okay, but I'm going to talk about constructions. So you take things which are non-compact. Yeah, I do. I'm going to talk about both. But do you get conical singularities that way? Because as far as I know, there are no examples. Okay, so just be patient. That's what we're talking about. Irreducible means full G2.
No,
no,
even if you twist.
Oh, so you get like some semi-direct product.
Yeah.
Okay. So this means take non-compact things, glue them together to get some compact thing, and then show that you have a G2 structure there which is sort of almost torsion-free, and then you want to perturb it using analysis to get a torsion-free one. So there's several of these. It started with Dominic Joyce. This is an analog of the Coomer construction of constructing Calabi-Yau's. You've either seen this or you haven't. So it's not the point of the talk. Then Alexei Kovalev, a few years later, glued together asymptotically cylindrical manifolds with a twist to make the holonomy full G2. Just last year, Alessio Corti, Mark Haskins, Johannes Nordström, and Tommaso Baccini gave a vast, vast generalization of the Kovalev construction. So they were able to construct many more asymptotically cylindrical Calabi-Yau's that can be used in this construction. And they increased it from sort of hundreds of examples to hundreds of thousands of examples, I believe, of compact G2 manifolds. And I have a construction with Dominic that we actually finished the math of about 2 or 3 years ago, and I'm still trying to find the time to write it all up, which I will talk about in the last half of the talk. This is a new construction of smooth compact G2 manifolds used by gluing Iguchi-Hansen spaces. And the reason I want to talk about this at the end is not just to sort of promote myself, but this construction can possibly be used to create G2 conifolds. So I will talk about that. Okay, so many constructions of compact smooth G2 manifolds, they're all sort of gluing constructions, and they all invoke this following general theorem of Joyce. So Joyce has a theorem that says if you have a compact manifold with a G2 structure, which is a 3 form with this non-degeneracy, if it's closed, then you're almost all the way there because it has to be closed and co-closed to be torsion-free. So suppose you're closed and that the rest of it, so the co-derivative, d star of phi, is sufficiently small. So you need to know that the L14 norm is sufficiently small and some other estimates. Then he proves using analysis that there is a torsion-free G2 structure, phi tilde, close to phi in the C0 norm, and they're in the same cohomology class. Okay? So the idea is you want to stay in the same cohomology class, so your new 3 form will be phi plus D of a 2 form, and you already know phi is closed, so phi tilde will still be closed. You just want phi tilde to be co-closed, but not with respect to the metric of phi, with respect to the metric of phi tilde. So that turns out to be a nonlinear elliptic equation of this form. Laplacian of sigma is, the Hodge-Laplacian of sigma is some nonlinear expression in sigma and its first derivatives. And then he proved that this equation has a solution. Okay? So these constructions give you thousands of examples now, but they're still probably only a very small part of the landscape. In other words, we're probably only finding G2 manifolds that are very particular, that are close to sort of very symmetric types of things. The solution to that equation is unique, yes. But is your question, is there a unique torsion-free in each cohomology class? No, we don't know that. It's open. So this shows local uniqueness. It shows that in any cohomology class that admits torsion-free G2 structures, then each one will be unique in a neighborhood of the cohomology class, of the representative in the cohomology class, but there may be other ones far away. So it's not as good as the Calabi-Yau uniqueness. Okay, this is about the moduli space. So let's fix a compact G2 manifold. This is all about the compact case. And we want to look at all torsion-free G2 structures on there modulo the appropriate notion of equivalence, which in this case is diffeomorphisms isotopic to the identity. So this is really the Teichmuller space, not the moduli space. And the theorem, again, in Joyce's original paper is that this is a smooth manifold, and it's locally diffeomorphic to an open subset of H3 of M. So the deformations are always unobstructed, just like in the Calabi-Yau case. But instead of proving it like the Tian-Todorov proof, this is an implicit function theorem proof. And the dimension is purely topological. The dimension of the moduli space is B3. So this is what I said. It's unobstructed, and the infinitesimal deformations have a topological interpretation. The proof has three ingredients, and I want to emphasize this because the result with Joyce is we get a version of this theorem for conifolds. So it uses the implicit function theorem, it uses Fredholm theory, and it uses Hodge theory. Now, number one is okay in the non-compact case, but number two and three definitely require compactness here. So the G2 conifold will be a non-compact kind of thing, and to prove a theorem like this, using an implicit function theorem type of argument, we're going to need to generalize 2 and 3 to the non-compact setting. Okay. That's the review of sort of smooth G2 geometry. Let's go into, before I can tell you what a G2 conifold is, I need to tell you what a G2 cone is. So take a 7-dimensional manifold, which is topologically an interval times a compact 6 manifold. And so a G2 cone will be topologically this with a torsion-free G2 structure whose metric, remember all the G2 structures induce a metric, whose metric is a cone metric, right? A Riemannian cone metric. So it turns out that the link of the G2 cone, this sigma, has a particular geometry. In order for the cone, the metric cone, to be G2, the link has to be what's called a compact, strictly nearly Kähler 6 manifold. These have an almost complex structure, which is never integrable, a metric, a Kähler form, an associated 1-1 form, which is never closed. Because they have an almost complex structure, then you can talk about the first Chern class of its tangent bundle. C1 is 0, but then D of little omega is related to big omega, and D of big omega is related to little omega. Okay, so these are what has to be the link of a G2 cone, and there are only 3 known compact examples. There are other non-compact, nearly Kähler, 6 manifolds, but we want compact for a cone. So there are only 3 known examples. They're all homogeneous. But we expect there should be many examples of G2 cones. The problem is that the equations to solve are very complicated, right? It's, again, there's no D-D-bar lemma on these manifolds, so you can't reduce it to a scalar equation. Okay, now that we know what a G2 cone is, there are 2 kinds of G2 conifolds. Those are the non-compact manifolds, G2 manifolds, that look like a cone at infinity, or they have a bunch of singular points where they look like a cone at the vertex. So this is the first example, the asymptotically conical G2 manifolds. So it's a G2 manifold, non-compact, such that if you take out a compact set, the remainder of it is diffeomorphic to a product, and sigma is a G2 cone here. So sigma is the link of this G2 cone. So if you look at the G2 cone structure on here and compare it with phi n, of course there should be pullbacks here and all that, but I'm ignoring it, I'm abusing notation, then the difference between phi n and phi c goes to zero as you go to infinity at a specified rate, and all the derivatives as well, all the covariant derivatives. Okay, there are three known examples of asymptotically conical G2 manifolds. These are the Bryant-Salomon manifolds I mentioned earlier. And they're asymptotic to the three known G2 cones. I said there's three known G2 cones. The rate is important because the result, the theorem I'm going to state, depends on the rate. So these two, the rank 3 bundles over a 4 manifold have rate -4, and the spinner bundle of S3 has rate -3. Okay? The theorem we're going to state has very, very different behavior depending on whether the rate is below or above -7/2. And all the known examples appear on both sides of that critical rate.
And there are no bounds.
What nu can be? There are no known bounds. We want nu to be negative. But it seems that something funny is happening at -5/2 and at -1. We don't exactly know. But there's no proof of anything like that. There's my picture of an asymptotically conical G2 manifold. Okay, the other ones are the conically singular G2 manifolds. So the picture, let me put the picture up right away. So these are, take a compact topological space such that if you remove a finite number of points, it becomes a non-compact smooth 7 manifold. So a conically singular G2 manifold is, this non-compact part has to be a G2 manifold of rate nu 1 up to nu n. All the nu i's are positive, so we can have a different rate of convergence at each of the singular points. Has to be positive. So that when you take out a compact set, the difference is a disjoint union of neighborhoods of the vertex of a bunch of G2 cones. And again, the G2 structure on M approaches each of these cone G2 structures at some rate, nu I, with all its derivatives. Okay? So I talked about examples. So like I said, apparently in M theory, you need compact G2 manifolds with conical singularities. I talked about examples of asymptotically conical. So let me talk about examples of conically singular. There are no known examples, right? But they're expected to exist in abundance. So it's not just that the physicists are asking for them and expect them to exist. There's mathematical evidence that they should exist, and lots of them. So I'm going to give you some of the mathematical evidence. So there is a possible construction of these guys. By generalizing my construction with Dominic of compact smooth G2 manifolds. So I will talk about that if I get a chance. I will talk about the construction with Dominic and how it could probably generalize to produce the first examples of CS G2 manifolds. But more evidence, which is rigorous, conically singular G2 manifolds should arise as boundary points in the moduli space of compact smooth G2 manifolds. So if you have a family of smooth compact G2 manifolds, which is developing in the limit some kind of singularity, in some sense, which I'll make precise, often these will be conical singularities. So, what do you mean in other terms? Oh, no, it's not like that. They're not orbifold. These can never be orbifold singularities. The isolated conical ones can't be orbifold. They're just isolated points. Yeah, you can talk about non-isolated conical singularities, and then maybe they can be orbifold, but these are not.
But that's what we want.
You want what?
Codimension 4.
Codimension 4. Okay, so we're starting base step 1. What was I going to say here? So. Suppose you had a conical singularity, right? If you can show that this will always be the limit of a family of smooth guys, then that's giving evidence that these should appear on the boundary of the moduli space. Okay? That's what I'm saying here. So if you had this, this is looking like a G2 cone down here. If you have an asymptotically conical G2 manifold that at infinity is looking like that same G2 cone, then you can try to patch them together and construct a smooth, compact G2 manifold. And that's exactly what I did 4 years ago. The theorem says if you had one, again, these don't exist yet, or we haven't proved that they exist, if you had a conically singular G2 manifold with isolated conical singularities modeled on these G2 cones, and suppose that you had the stuff that you want to attach. Suppose you had asymptotically conical G2 manifolds modeled on the same cones, and there's a technical reason you want all the rates to be no greater than -3. Okay? Then there's a certain necessary topological condition that has to be satisfied for this to have any hope of succeeding, and it relates all the singular points together. If that necessary condition is satisfied, it turns out it's sufficient always. You can always glue the NIs to M to get a smooth, compact G2 manifold. There's my fancy picture. So this cannot be improved. So it's sharp, but luckily all the known examples satisfy this bound, so that's okay. So that's some evidence. So not only are we getting a desingularization, but you actually get a one-parameter family of desingularizations, which in some limit, in some Gromov-Hausdorff sense, converges to the original conifold. Okay, so why do we want to understand how G2 conifolds, whether they're AC or CS, how they deform? Well, first of all, if we know what's the moduli space of AC guys, then it's telling us how many different ways can we resolve a conically singular guy, because we can resolve it by gluing in an asymptotically conical thing. And if there's lots of different choices asymptotic to the same cone, then there would be a large family of desingularizations. And understanding how we can deform these guys, the conically singular guys, tells us how much of the boundary of the moduli space of smooth G2 manifolds should be conically singular ones. Because I've argued that they should appear on the boundary, and then if they're there, and if they deform, then they'll tell us how much of the boundary they make up. Okay, so let me give you the definition of the moduli space. So take a G2 conifold of rate nu. So in the AC case, that's a negative number. And in the CS case, it's a n-tuple of positive numbers. And the moduli space will be all the torsion-free G2 structures on that underlying smooth manifold, which are asymptotic to the same cones at the ends with the same rates, modulo diffeomorphisms that preserve this condition. So we fix the cones at the ends because, well, first of all, to make the problem simpler, but also we don't know how G2 cones deform, because to know how G2 cones deform, you need to know how strictly nearly Kähler 6 manifolds deform. There's some work by some people on the infinitesimal deformations of this, but nothing is known about non-infinitesimal deformations. So that's the definition of the moduli space. I'm going to give you the theorem on the next slide. It involves some natural maps and cohomology. There's a map which takes a class in HK and sends it to classes on the link. So what you do is you have class in HK. It's represented by some form. So look at the restriction to a neighborhood of the end of infinity or the singular point. Then that gives you a class on a manifold which is topologically a sigma times an interval, and it has the same topology as sigma. So you just restrict and take the class there. So these are some natural maps in topology, and Ki is a space of solutions of a differential equation on the cone. So you look at the space of what's called homogeneous closed and co-closed three forms on the cone of rate lambda. So I define these here because they're in the statement of the theorem. Here's the theorem. For generic rates, there's a strictly finite set of critical rates where you can't say anything. This is the theorem. If you have an AC G2 manifold, if the rate is between -4 and -5/2, then the moduli space is smooth, just like in the compact case. So it's unobstructed. And the dimension is given by this formula. So between -4 and -3, it's equal to H3CS, compactly supported homology. And then when you cross -3, -3 is one of these finite critical rates. When you cross -3, you pick up another topological contribution, that map on the previous slide. And then as you move up from -3 to -5/2, you pick up analytic contributions, the dimensions of these spaces of solutions of differential equation on the cone. So it's like the compact case in that it's unobstructed, and it's mostly topological, but there can be analytic contributions to the deformations. If you're in the AC case with rate less than minus 4, then it may not be unobstructed. There could be obstruction, so we can compute the virtual dimension, and there's topological contributions and then analytic contributions to the virtual dimension. In the CS case, it's the same as the AC case for less than minus 4. So it could be obstructed, and you can compute the virtual dimension in terms of topological and analytic data. So I want to say a few words here. In all the obstructed cases, the obstruction space can be described explicitly. It's a space of forms on the cone of degree 2 plus 4, which are in the kernel of D plus D star, but whose pure degree components are not independently closed and co-closed. What does that mean? If you're in the kernel of D plus D star, then you're in the kernel of D plus D star squared, so you're harmonic. So you have a form which is a mixed degree. It's a 2 form plus a 4 form, and it's harmonic. You can't argue that the 2 form part and the 4 form part are independently closed and co-closed because you're not in L2. You can't integrate by parts. And the failure of this to happen is exactly what causes obstructions. The proof uses what's called Lockhart-McCohen method of basically getting Fredholm theory on non-compact manifolds by changing your Sobolev spaces to have controlled decay at the ends. And then you have to get Hodge theory results in this context, in this non-compact context, and then some other ingredients. So there's a lot of ingredients to the proof. But I'm not going to talk about the proof. I want to talk about applications of this theorem, because it had actually much more applications than we were expecting. First application is, you look at the Bryan-Solomon examples, you can compute their deformation space. And it turns out they're all rigid. They have no deformations. There's always this trivial deformation, which is a scaling at infinity and reparametrization. So that's always there. But if you take that one away, there's no non-trivial deformations, which is probably why no one has found any other asymptotically conical G2 manifolds. If you have a conically singular one whose singularities are all from two of the three known examples, I said there's three known G2 cones. There are probably lots of them, but there's three known ones. If all the singularities come from two of the three known links, then all the obstructions turn out to vanish, and the CS moduli space is smooth. And this statement in the first half of number 2 is actually going to be true in general if we know something about strictly nearly Kähler deformations. So there's some question you can ask. It says that if you have a coexact 2 form, which is an eigenform for the Laplacian on a compact strictly nearly Kähler 6 manifold with eigenvalue 12, if that does not actually correspond to a strictly nearly Kähler deformation, then this will be true in general. And we don't know how to check that. Okay, so if you're in the case where the moduli space is smooth, so if all the links are of these two types, or if this general question turns out to be true, so if the CS moduli space is smooth, then you can do two things. You can say, well, let me just have a picture with one singularity. If it's smooth, you can compute the dimension of this moduli space. But you also know from my earlier theorem that you can desingularize to get something compact. And that compact thing has basically degenerates to the singular guy. So you can compute from Dominic's theorem the dimension of the moduli space of the smooth guys. And it turns out the dimension of the CS moduli is exactly one less than the dimension of the moduli of the smooth guys. So it's saying that somehow these conical singularities are the highest dimensional stratum of the boundary, whatever the boundary looks like. So in other words, most of the ways that a smooth G2 manifold can become singular, most is in quotations because I haven't made this precise, is to develop these kinds of isolated conical singularities. And like that's what I said about something about the nearly Kähler 6 manifolds. Okay, so this is the main theorem in my paper with Lotte that we understand the deformations of asymptotically conical or conically singular G2 manifolds. This theorem so far is useless unless there's examples, right? Because there's still no known examples. It's not useless because this fact tells you that if they're there, if the CS guys are there, they should be making up a huge part of the boundary of the smooth moduli. But what I'd like to do is construct an example, the first example of CS compact G2 manifolds. And we have a proposed method to do this. It's going to be an offshoot of this construction that I was talking about. I have a new construction with Joyce of smooth compact G2 manifolds, which I will describe now. The problem with this construction is that it fails very often. The feature of this construction is that it looks like that when it's failing, it's really giving us those guys, the CS guys. We haven't proved that yet. So I'm going to describe this construction of smooth compact G2 manifolds. As I said, this is not online yet, but the math is done. And then I'll explain why it fails a lot and why it's probably, hopefully, giving us CS guys. Okay, I think I have enough time. Okay. And this comes from a different talk, and there's a lot of high-tech graphics in here that you'll see. So step one, we construct an orbifold. So the construction is actually more general than this, but this is all we need to understand the idea in principle. So you start with a compact Calabi-Yau manifold, N, with all its associated machinery, tensors, and you want one that has an anti-holomorphic isometric involution, right? So that means it's an isometry, it's anti-holomorphic, and these follow from the first and the fourth. So there are lots of such Calabi-Yau. So if you took a quintic in P4 with real coefficients, then conjugation gives you something like that. Now, this is what I said earlier. Take the product with a circle. Define this three form on it. Whether you put a plus or a minus here depends on what orientation you're putting on M. It's not a big deal. This is now a torsion-free G2 structure on M, but it's not full G2. It's got holonomy SU3. We have an involution on N, so we can combine that with a reflection on the circle to get an involution of the 7 manifold, and it's clear that it preserves phi because this omega goes to omega bar, so the real part doesn't change, and theta and little omega both change signs, so the whole thing is invariant. So we have an involution of M which preserves the G2 structure. You can take the quotient of M by the action of this involution, you get a G2 orbifold, and it has singularities codimension 4, right? So it's of codimension 4. The singular set is a three-dimensional submanifold, and the singularities locally look like R3 times C2 over plus or minus 1. In fact, the singular set is two copies of a special Lagrangian submanifold in N. That's not so important here. But it's also true that the submanifold L of M is totally geodesic. That is important in our proof, in our construction, but you won't see that here. So anyway, I'm just making a remark. So that's step one. You construct this orbifold. Step two, you want to glue in a family of Iguchi-Hansen spaces. Why do we want to do that? Because the singularities look like C2 over plus or minus 1. And when you blow this up at the origin, you get a Iguchi-Hansen space. So we want to cut out a neighborhood of the singular locus in the orbifold and glue in a family parameterized by that base L, a family of Iguchi-Hansen spaces, to get topologically a smooth compact manifold. And we hope that you can find a closed G2 structure on there with small enough torsion to just apply Domnick's theorem that says there exists a torsion-free one. And if you do it the right way and you compute the topology, if the fundamental group is finite, you know it'll be full G2. Okay. So L is a compact submanifold of M. M was compact. So you can find an open neighborhood of L, which is diffeomorphic to a neighborhood of the zero section in the normal bundle using the exponential map. This is the sort of tubular neighborhood theorem. So L is our totally geodesic submanifold in M. And if you look at a neighborhood of L, it's diffeomorphic to a neighborhood of the zero section in the normal bundle of L. These are my high-tech graphics, by the way. So I said L is a special two copies of a special Lagrangian. You can do this more generally. You don't have to start with a Calabi-Yau. What's always true is that L will be associative. So in particular, because of the structure of associative submanifolds, it turns out that if you have a non-vanishing one form on L, then this normal bundle is not just an R4 bundle. It's actually a C2 bundle. There's a complex structure on the fibers. And the above diffeomorphism, this picture here, it actually descends to the quotient. The quotient on the left being M mod the action of the involution to get the orbifold. And here you get a bundle of C2s over plus or minus 1. So that's here. That's the orbifold. And near L, this is diffeomorphic to the normal bundle quotient by plus or minus 1 on the fibers. So the fibers of this bundle is a fiber bundle with fibers C2 over plus or minus 1. We want to do a fiber-wise blow-up resolution to replace each fiber with Iguchi-Hansen space topologically. And we want to know, well, remember, we want to construct a torsion, a G2 structure with small torsion on the resolved manifold. So it'll depend on which Iguchi-Hansen space we take, because the three form will be constructed out of the three Iguchi-Hansen hyperkähler forms on T star on the fiber. So you need to know which Iguchi-Hansen space to glue in. So the moduli space of Iguchi-Hansen spaces, of Iguchi-Hansen metrics on T star of S2 is R3 minus the origin, because you need a vector in S2 to tell you which complex structure you're using in the S2 family, and you need a positive real number for the overall scale. Okay? Now, if the normal bundle was trivial, which it's not in general, and if the associative submanifold was a torus, which it's not in general, then you can take any Iguchi-Hansen metric on T star of S2 and then just take the same one everywhere, have it be constant, and you would get a torsion-free G2 structure on this guy, on the resolution, P tilde, which is the fiber-wise resolution blow-up of P. Okay? But you can't, because in general, L is not a torus, and the normal bundle is not trivial. So there's no canonical torsion-free G2 structure on the piece you're gluing in. Okay? So you have to work harder. And since the moduli space of Iguchi-Hansen's is exactly R3 minus 0, we want to choose an element of R3 minus 0 at every point on our submanifold L. So that's really saying the Iguchi-Hansen you're going to glue in is corresponding to this non-vanishing one-form on L, which is giving us our complex structure on the fibers. So we have our non-vanishing one-form on L. It's telling us how to view the fiber as a complex vector space, and also which it's telling you which Iguchi-Hansen space to choose. So when you do that, you can actually find a closed three-form on this fiber-wise blow-up, P tilde, a closed G2 structure with small torsion, but it's not small enough to use Joyce's theorem. In order for it to have any chance of being small enough, you need this one-form to be harmonic on L. Has to be a non-vanishing harmonic one-form on L. So that's the part that usually fails. But let's pretend we have this. So assume we have a nowhere vanishing harmonic one-form on the submanifold L. Step three, okay? We have our orbifold has a torsion-free G2 structure, but it's singular. And our fiber-wise blow-up of Iguchi-Hansen spaces has a G2 structure which is not torsion-free, but it has small torsion, if we assume alpha is harmonic. And then we glue them together, we interpolate between them, and then we want to define a G2 structure on the whole thing. So this is the orbifold. This is the bundle of C2s over plus or minus 1. Okay? So near L, these things are the same. So we identify this blue shaded area. And then the fiber-wise blow-up of P to P tilde is a bundle of T star of S2s. And near L, again, this matches with this. So this is the sort of intermediate space to match between here and here. So this is the exponential map. Sorry, this is the exponential map, and this is the resolution map, blow-up map. So it turns out there's a canonical G2 structure you can put on here by expanding, pushing forward the G2 structure from here by this diffeomorphism, and expanding it in a power series where T is the distance to the zero section. So there's a nice way to do that. And so we get our compact smooth 7 manifold. And you want to have a closed G2 structure on there with small enough torsion. So you can patch together these three forms to make a closed three form, closed G2 structure. It's just not co-closed. Okay? And you want to measure how far away is it from being co-closed. Remember, there was this strong assumption that we had this nowhere vanishing harmonic one form, that without that, you can't get anywhere. Okay, so this is technical. Let's ignore this. But it turns out that the torsion is still too big, always too big, in order to apply Dominic's theorem, even if we have this harmonic one-form. This does not happen in all the other constructions of compact G2 manifolds, because if you start with the right pieces, you have to get the pieces that match together. And if you have them, when you put them together, it works. You can just apply Dominic's theorem. You can get a small enough torsion. Here we have to work harder again. And the problem is that the space that we're gluing in, this this bundle of Iguchi Hansen spaces doesn't have a torsion-free G2 structure on it. It's already not small enough. The piece we're gluing in is not good enough. And we have to introduce this intermediary manifold, which creates additional complications. So I'm running out of time, so I'll skip that. We have to perform two corrections to solve this. Step four is the first correction, is the intermediate space that was sort of interpolating between the other two. We weren't doing the right identification. Some of the torsion is artificial because of identifying these spaces in the wrong way. And if you bend what the horizontal spaces are by changing the connection on the normal bundle, and if you, for the exponential map, and if you also bend the vertical spaces by choosing an appropriate vector field on M, then you can correct these artificial torsions. This contribution to the torsion, which was a result of not looking at the problem in the right way. This is actually very interesting how it's done, but you know, I don't have time, and I'm not going to say any more about it. So you can do this, but it's still not good enough. You got to do another correction. So you have to modify the G2 structure on this bundle of Iguchi Hansens to again, and it's because the naive choice that comes from the parametrization by this one-form alpha is not the right one. So you postulate that there's a correction term. You want to add a small piece to your three-form, keeping it a closed G2 structure, and make the torsion smaller. And when you write down what has to be done, it turns out that you need to solve an elliptic PDE on each Iguchi Hansen space, right? So it's an elliptic equation on a non-compact manifold, but it's one with nice asymptotics at infinity. So the right-hand side comes from the original G2 structure on P tilde. This is some known mixed degree form, and you need to find an unknown mixed degree form that's the solution to that equation. So you can use the usual Fredholm theory for non-compact manifolds with well-behaved geometry at infinity, and you can show that this does have a solution. So you can correct it. You can correct it, and you can get compact smooth G2 manifolds. Can I do my three more slides? So the first observation to make is you can get compact smooth G2 manifolds. The natural question is, are these new or are they already in the list? Before last year's paper by those four authors, we had a hope of checking this. We haven't, so we've plugged in three or four examples of Calabi-Yau's with anti-holomorphic isometric involution and see what we get. And the first three or four examples we picked, we got Betti numbers that were already on Dominic's list. Right? That doesn't mean they're not new, right? They just could have the same Betti numbers. But he's absolutely convinced, and he has much better intuition for this than I do, that we are getting new ones. I don't remember. I'd have to check my notes.
This is 2010. Anyway, so
he has no doubt that this will produce examples that were not in his book, right? Now the other guys have, you know, 100,000 examples. I'm hoping these are new. They're really constructed in a very different way, so they really should be giving us new ones. But I want to make some remarks. So first of all, it's a bit more general. You don't have to start with a Calabi-Yau. You can start with a compact G2 manifold that has an involution like this, and then everything proceeds as before. So you can go from a compact G2 manifold to a compact G2 manifold, but that's not very useful really at this point because we don't have compact G2 manifolds with such an involution unless they're reduced holonomy, but we wanted to write the theorem as generally as possible. Again, the examples we're getting, hopefully they are different from the earlier ones, but still we probably are only getting a small piece of the landscape. But here's the main problem, right? We can't usually guarantee that this submanifold, this totally geodesic associative submanifold, or special Lagrangian, will have a nowhere vanishing harmonic one form, because how do you find the harmonic one forms? It comes from the induced metric on L, and that's induced from the Calabi-Yau metric on the Calabi-Yau, which we don't know explicitly, right? So it's impossible to really check this. And in general, a harmonic one form will have isolated zeros. It will not be non-vanishing. But again, this comes back to mirror symmetry again. If you know your Calabi-Yau is near the large complex structure limit, then arguments from mirror symmetry say that you should expect your Calabi-Yau to have a special Lagrangian torus that is close to being flat. So if it's close to being flat, then it will have non-vanishing harmonic one forms because the flat torus does. So there are situations where you can argue that alpha, that there will be a non-vanishing harmonic one form. But generically, it won't. It'll have isolated zeros. So what our construction does is it resolves M almost everywhere. There's a finite number of points where we didn't know what Yaguchi-Hansen space to glue in. And we still have a singularity left over. It's not a smooth manifold. And you can show, literally, Dominic showed me this on the back of an envelope. It was the back of the envelope calculation that topologically, what you're getting near the singular points is a cone over CP3, topological CP3. But there is a G2 cone whose link is CP3. I told you there are three known G2 cones. I didn't really list them. One of them has link, which is CP3 topologically. It's not Kähler. It's what's called the nearly Kähler CP3. So you can imagine you've got something now which has, you've resolved most of it, and you have a G2 structure, closed G2 structure with small torsion here, but the torsion is getting too big near the singularities. If you can now, don't change the topology anymore, leave the singular points in, and just change the three form again, only near here, to try to make the torsion small enough, and hopefully deform it to a compact CS G2 manifold. So that's what you need. That's what the physicists want. But now you're telling me you want codimension 4. We'll start with this. It could be interesting. Okay.
Well, I think the codimension 4 is for gate fill, and codimension 4. Yeah. Like it says, matter. Matter, yeah, for matter. Yeah.
So to do this, this is the last slide. To do this, we need two things. First of all, we would construct a closed G2 structure with small torsion, but it's not on a smooth manifold. It's on one of these things with conical singularities. So Joyce's theorem is in this compact smooth case. So we would need a version of Joyce's existence theorem for CS Riemannian manifolds. And the other piece is we need to know what's happening here. We're looking at a point in the moduli space of Yaguchi-Hansens when you're going to the origin. The origin corresponds to the singular Yaguchi-Hansen, C2 over plus or minus 1. So as you look at the total space of Yaguchi-Hansens near zero, near the singular one, that seven-dimensional manifold should have a torsion-free G2 structure on it. It should be the Brian-Salomon G2 cone. And there should be a way of interpolating between this and this in a way which doesn't let the torsion ever get too big. So that's part two. Okay, so if we can do this, these would be the first G2 CS, compact CS manifolds. And then, as a sort of an aside, if you can do that, now you have CS guys, so you can desingularize again using my earlier theorem to still get compact smooth guys. So if you really want smooth guys, this construction, even though it fails often, if it's really producing these, then you can do one more gluing and smoothing out again. So this is work in progress with Jason. We've done part one. That wasn't actually that hard. We're working on this, and that will probably take us quite some time because Dominic seems to think it's too hard. Luckily, I'm ignoring him because he's moved on to other things. He doesn't care anymore about G2. So hopefully he's hopefully it's sometimes it's good to be ignorant a bit, right? Because if we don't quite understand why he thinks it's too hard, we might find a way to do it. But if we believe him, then we may be discouraged and not even try.
An analog of the large populace. Yeah, because you consider just very special Gromov-Hausdorff limits.
Yeah.
And for the Kaleidi-Yau, probably SYZ, as it was stated, it's not true. But there is a better way to consider Gromov-Hausdorff limits of Kaleidi-Yau near the large complex fracture limit. There is a conjecture, it's 14 years old, it's formulated by Maxim. How the limit should look like. So if you take U, which is a product of Kaleidi-Yau across S1, so of course you can perform this limit. So the product will be something like topologically it's product of three-dimensional sphere by S1. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so then there is a nice description which plays a role in mirror symmetry.
No one has tried to describe what the analog would be for the G2 moduli space. It could be hidden in some of the physics literature that I haven't been able to decipher, but not no mathematicians. Yeah, the base is three-dimensional.
limit of collabial extreme.
But he said the SOD base and the D2 case is three.
The base is again three dimensional. The fibers are four dimensional.
So what's happening if we take G2, which is a product of
collabial? Yeah, so it's special dimensions, and then the other circle is in the fiber, right?
So
if you have a collabial three times S1, then if this is fibering with special Lagrangian, because if you take a special Lagrangian torus in here times this, that's co-associative torus. Yeah. I don't know.
Last construction. So this is like local operation near this fixed point of the
dimension. Yeah.
So,
well,
like
the problem is that the fixed points are three-dimensional family. Right?
Yeah.
How does it look? Does it look something like Atiyah Hitchin and two tau knots? If you view it from the three, it's one vibration of a three.
I haven't thought about that. That's a good question. You mean the whole resolution near the.
That what possibly you expect from the sense, but I don't.
Maybe you can explain it to me. Okay. No, I haven't thought about that.